taken to the streets to fight for our futures.
Le nationalisme, c'est la guerre.
Big issues in society are based on value judgment.
The Progressive Pod, the podcast of FEPS, Foundation for European Progressive Studies. In this podcast, we interview personalities from the EU to boost the progressive debate across Europe.
How will last spring's elections to the European Parliament affect the balance of power between the institutions of the European Union? Thank you very much for tuning in and welcome to the Progressive Pod. This is Olaf Bruns, Deputy Editor-in-Chief of the Progressive Post, and in this issue we come back on the European elections with the Dutch historian Luc van Middelaar. In his recent book, Alarums and Excursions, Improvising Politics on the European Stage, van Middelaar analyzes how a decade of crises, from the financial chaos of the euro and the Greek sovereign debt, the conflicts with Russia over Ukraine, unprecedented levels of refugees coming from across the Mediterranean, to the turmoil created by Brexit, have shaped a new way of doing politics on the European stage. Luc van Middelaar.
Your recent book, which was first published in Dutch under the name The Nieuwe Politiek van Europa, well, The New Politics of Europe, has become, in the English translation, Alarums and Excursions, Improvising Politics on the European Stage. Now, that is a title that probably needs some explanation. But I had to admit, I had to look up alarums in the dictionary.
Well, so did I, in a way. I changed the title for the English edition because I wanted to underline the importance of the theatre and the theatricality in a way of politics. And one of the key things we've seen in the past years is that more and more politics in the EU is playing out on stage, in the public sight, in the limelight, whereas historically a lot of EU politics took more place backstage, let's say. So I wanted to stress this, and then my English publisher came up with this expression, Alarums and Excursions, which is in fact from the Shakespearean theater. It's a stage direction, and it means that the actors have to prepare for imminent action and hectic scenes and perhaps a battle. The idea is that it evokes that moment right before action, which I found rather appropriate for the 10 years of EU crisis politics I try to describe in the book.
And then you open with a quote from somebody who has been a lot on stage, Miles Davis.
The quote is by Miles Davis, who once said, "I will play it first and tell you what it is later." And with this, I wanted to underline the other aspect of the title, that of improvisation. That is, for 10 years, EU leaders and institutions had to act, had to rush, had to improvise, to invent things on the spot. And nobody was quite knowing what they were doing. It was as if we were running breathlessly from one crisis to the next, right? And I thought, well, okay, maybe now after 10 years, if you start in 2008 with the financial crisis, etc., it's time to take a step back and to see what collectively we or the EU has been doing. Hence this Miles Davis quote to, okay, well, let's now take a look. Enough improvisation, and can we make some sense of all of this?
Now, one of the actors that has become center stage in these improvisations is the European Council. And it's one of the actors that are often described as in conflict when analyzing how the European Union works with another actor, which is the Parliament on the other side. So between a federalist and an intergovernmental construction. But you distinguish three approaches.
Yeah, I distinguish three because I think historically the first approach, I call the backstage approach, was the idea to depoliticize conflict. It's basically the technocratic approach where the Commission, as a technocratic, impartial expert body, is center stage together with the Court of Justice. And what you then see is that there are two political approaches to how to do EU politics, how to involve the citizens. And these one could call the federalist and the confederalist, as opposed to the technocratic functionalist. With the federalist being embodied institutionally, I guess most convincingly by the European Parliament as the body representing EU citizens, and with the confederalist approach in a way embodied by the European Council as the body of national leaders. I think that threefold distinction makes more sense if you want to understand the clashes and rivalries between institutions, because it shows you that there are two institutions, and the ones you mentioned, the European Council and the European Parliament, even if they may be at odds sometimes, they both share something. They both thrive under the public eye. They both look for visibility. They look for contact with citizens, unlike the Commission, the Court, and the Council of Ministers, which has to be distinguished from the European Council. And the Council of Ministers is really part of the technocratic apparatus of civil servants.
What was the reason for having an interest in this depolitization? And why did so many, well, also political leaders, fall in line with this?
Well, I think you have to understand that the strategy of depoliticization is pretty much the DNA of the EU. It's how it all started. And back in the 1950s, it was obviously a brilliant idea. At heart, it comes down to saying, listen, we as countries, we do not have so much conflicts. We rather have problems together. Huh? This was the idea of Jean Monnet, Schuman, and these founding fathers. And problems you can solve. You can give a solution, either a legal or a procedural solution, to make them disappear or to sweep them under the carpet.
Do you see with the increased participation in the European elections that there is a little bit of a power shift between these three institutions? A kind of tectonic shift of influence, power, authority?
I think the European Parliament is a clear winner of the election, and in particular because of the high turnout. Because the Parliament's weakest point has always been the link to the voters. I mean, formally speaking, and in terms of its competences, the European Parliament is, of course, a very powerful parliament. Even if you compare it to many national parliaments, it has nothing to be jealous of. But its weak spot has been to also be seen and be found credible as a public arena speaking on behalf of all European citizens. So again, to sum up, it is strong as a legislator, or co-legislator, but it fulfilled the other role of a parliament, that of public arena, less convincingly. And I think that is changing now. The turnout above the, of course, symbolic threshold of 50% is very important. Also the fact that the almost eternal decline has been quite assuredly reversed, and also the fact that there are more diverse voices within that parliament, that the old monopoly or duopoly, as people sometimes said, of the Christian Democrats, EPP, and the Social Democrats, S&D, has been broken down, that there are new players with stronger voices and also needed for a majority, the Greens, the Liberals, but also the Nationalist Populists. Even their presence, I would argue, although many in Brussels are worried about it, but even their presence paradoxically could strengthen the parliament. Why? Because it makes it more credible for the European Parliament to say, okay, listen, we are the body where all voices, the plurality of public opinion in the EU is represented. And this is one place where we fight it out rhetorically, politically, in the plenary above all, and that makes the European Parliament less of a, let's say, Brussels Parliament, but more of a European Parliament, and it will make it stronger also vis-a-vis the other two institutions.
What we see now is that we are going to a not only grand coalition, große Koalition, as they say in Germany, but we're going to an even bigger one, which not only includes the Social Democrats and the EPP, but also the Liberals and the Greens. Now, if you consider that the confrontation of political ideas is the lifeblood of democracy, isn't there a risk that basically you have everybody who is remotely pro-European in the majority and only those who are really against it in the opposition?
To me, the key question is how that right-wing, extreme right-wing, will behave itself. I think that this generation of anti-European nationalists will behave differently from the previous generation. If you look at Marine Le Pen and Nigel Farage, which have been almost for 20 years, both of them MEPs, they basically used the European Parliament for two reasons. One is as background for their YouTube films, let's say for their public communication. And secondly, I'm sad to say, for the money. They used the EP as a source of money, knowing that domestically they were ill-represented and that they needed that kind of money flows. Now, the new generation, let's say the Salvini-Orban generation of anti-European populists, I think they want to do business. They want to have an impact on decision-making, in particular on the whole field of migration, asylum, and all these kind of issues. And don't forget, Matteo Salvini and Viktor Orban, they are in government at home. So they are not opposition clowns, if I may say so, like Farage. They know what it's like to make decisions, and they will want to, or their parties to, bring that in Brussels too. The question is whether these kind of opposition movements will only make fools of themselves or play the purely anti-European destruction or leave card, like UKIP or the previous Front National, or whether they want to be more a legitimate opposition within the system, saying, okay, we don't want to destroy the EU, we want to be part of it, but we want to change some of the policies. And that's an important distinction between these two kinds of opposition. And
because it shifts from an opposition of principle against the whole theater, basically, to becoming an actor on the stage of
that
theater.
An actor on the stage and perhaps a dissonant voice, but not willing to basically bring down the whole theater. And that is a key difference. It means that, again, paradoxically, they may strengthen the legitimacy of the project as a whole because they are buying into it with their, and even thanks to their, dissonance.
A way to handle dissonant voices on that European stage has always been the technocratical approach. It was a little bit, well, you are against the European Union, you probably don't understand it.
The technocratic approach is indeed no longer credible for all the issues the EU is dealing with today, and that the approach of the moral high ground, which often came second, because first people said, okay, you don't like it, A, it means you didn't understand it, so I'll explain it again, and if you then still don't understand it, then B, probably you're not a good European. And that approach, people are also becoming a bit allergic. So what else to do is, of course, to have a political narrative of why certain decisions are taken in the name of a certain view of the future, a certain vision for society as a whole. And I think that is more important now than in the past. Because even if I'm critical, also in the book, of the technocratic approach, it is fair enough for large parts of building an EU market. Well, yeah, it is rather technical stuff, to harmonize, VAT rates, or to invent rules for food hygiene. It's great to reunite experts and so on. But again, for a lot of the key issues that are dealt with today by European states and institutions together, the refugee crisis, the same is true to a large extent for the euro, or what to do with Russia. These are deep fundamental issues involving not only matters of expertise, but really values of, well, take the refugee crisis, solidarity versus perhaps security and identity. And these are the kind of issues where the technocratic approach definitely is not credible. It's not by bringing together 28 national experts and people from the Commission and the Parliament that you're going to decide, okay, what are we going to do with 1.2 million refugees? Personally, I'm a bit worried that the EU is not yet crisis-proof when it comes to a new crisis in the neighborhood, inflow of refugees, with the kind of numbers as we have seen in 2015-16. So I think that is a matter of urgency. That requires of the EU institutions to have places within structures, starting with the political executive, where you can discuss about such dilemmas as economy versus security.
Which is then bringing complex issues front stage.
Which is bringing exactly complex issues front stage, which is, I think, also what the voters are expecting. I mean, they have clearly expressed with the high turnout and with how they voted that the EU matters to them, that they have come to realize since 10 years that the EU affects their daily lives, their values, their interests. But they also have expressed a wish for change by voting for new parties and powers. And I think between now and 5 years, voters will want to see results on these issues like climate, migration, and the big challenges for the future like AI and China. And they will look to the most visible institutions, the parliament, the commission, and especially its president, and also their national leaders in the European Council. And they will use all occasions, all elections in the EU, including national elections, when it is about their own leaders not taking the right decision in the European arena, to make their voices heard.
Thank you very much for listening. This was the Progressive Pod with the Dutch historian Luc van Middelaar.